with our resident scholar, economist, statistician, criminologist, you name it. He's done it all, Dr. John Lott. He's a professor, he's an author, a former member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission, and is what I guess is considered provocative, but given what you just said, it shouldn't be. That given the fact that as you pointed out in an op-ed with the New York Post recently, that we can't be guaranteed our safety by psychiatry, the cops can't be everywhere. Maybe there's an entitlement crisis where people go postal because we've got a generation of spoiled, troubled young people. Who knows? But we're not going to solve this thing tomorrow. So in the meantime, we ought to be able to defend ourselves.
Yeah. And one of the things that was interesting, within hours after the tragedy in Santa Barbara, we had people coming out and saying, well, we have to spend more money on mental health. This proves that we have to have more money spent on mental health. The thing is, the Santa Barbara killer was already seeing several psychiatrists. One of the psychiatrists that he was seeing is a nationally renowned psychiatrist. I mean, what would more money have done in that case? And the thing is, you talk about any of the well-known shootings, the prominent shootings, are basically they've all been going to see psychiatrists, basically. Many of them prominent psychiatrists, and so more money isn't obvious.
But the shooter in Santa Barbara, and I think this is the point I was getting at when that happened a couple of weeks ago, refused to take his meds. Now, there's a group of people, and I think the verdict's out on this. I'm neutral because I'm not a psychiatrist or an MD, but there's a group of people out there, as you know, that think a lot of these serotonin reuptake inhibitors are actually doing more harm than good. Then there are people out there saying, no, it's the lack of people being forced to take them. We do know that the shooter in Santa Barbara said, well, I'm not going to take it. It's not good for me. So if they're going to for mental health treatment, but they're not following it, then it isn't much good.
Right. Well, I'm not sure whether we can blame it for whether they're taking the drugs or not, but surely that's some consideration. The thing is, you have these psychiatrists who have legal liability if they don't believe that this person is following a regimen that could go and thus lead him to be violent towards others. They have ultimate responsibility, and they're not flagging these cases. I mean, one of the amazing things that you see is that time after time in these cases, the psychiatrists are on record essentially saying that these individuals are not a danger to themselves or others.
But what explains this?
Think that there's a chance that somebody's not taking their drugs, and they think that could cause them to be violent towards others.
Well, then, you point out, John, in your piece in the Post that look, a very tiny percentage of even schizophrenics, bipolar, turn out to be actual threats, and yet in the 1940s and 50s, and correct me if my history is wrong, we did not seem to have these sorts of random shootings in pattern the way we do now, yet there were more guns available. High school kids brought guns to school for work or for hunting after school, what have you. And there was less money spent on mental health. What was the difference?
Right. If you go back at least since the 60s, we've had a fairly constant rate of these types of attacks. And attacks were also pretty high if you go back to the 1920s or something like that. But we have a problem here. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I don't see how. I mean, maybe if we have involuntary.
That was where I was going. There's an outside chance. I think this was your point in the piece. There's no guarantee, but there was an outside chance that some of these kids, the Holmes, the Kleibolds, the deranged shooter at Virginia Tech, Santa Barbara. One or two of those may have been involuntarily committed, said you're not taking your meds. Your parents are putting you, or the court is putting you, in a mental health hospital, and you're not going to have a choice.
Right. Well, you would think, though, these psychiatrists would have to make a case to a court that they were a danger to others when they weren't taking these drugs. And yet none of these psychiatrists were making the case. Now, the interesting thing is that there's this whole literature in psychiatry about how psychiatrists continually miss these really violent cases. And you know, there are lots of reasons why they give, and I think you hit on one just a minute ago, and that is how incredibly rare these instances are. And so, I mean, you're talking about something well less than a 1 out of 100,000. When you have such a rare number, you can understand why it's hard to identify. If I have 100,000 schizophrenics, and I say identify the 1% who are greatest at risk, even if I take 1,000 of those, 999 plus of those are going to be what we call false positives. You guess wrong, you know, you're identifying people at risk who they're really not. And so you can understand why, you know, they wouldn't want to lock up all sorts of people when they're unlikely to get the person who really poses the risk. But, you know, we end up in a situation, as you were saying before, and that is if, for whatever reason, psychiatrists don't even believe themselves that they're good at identifying these individuals, what's your backup plan? What do you do at that point? It'd be wonderful if tomorrow psychiatrists could come to us and say, you know, we figured out what was going wrong. We know how to go and solve this now. Mm-hmm. That would be great. But they don't, you read the literature that the psychiatrists write, and they constantly are saying that they don't have confidence in being able to identify these individuals.
Well, that gets to the analogy I was going to make before the break, and that is more than the TSA, more than the $1 trillion I think we spent in a couple of wars across the globe, the reason we're not seeing plane hijackings is because passengers are now all pretty much in agreement, and armed marshals to boot, but even passengers who are unarmed, that they will fight back. What Flight 93 taught the would-be perpetrator, hijacker, or terrorist on a plane is, from now on, they're going to get resistance.
Well, and that's exactly what they don't want. You know you're going to die. You know that the guy's going to crash the plane. I mean, 9/11 kind of changed the calculus. Before, when you had people hijack planes, you'd be hijacked, take them someplace else, and then they'd give up the plane, and the passengers would probably live. But now, if you believe the point of hijacking the planes is to go and crash into the buildings, and you know it may be difficult to attack the people, but the alternative is death anyway, you're going to have a number of passengers who say, look, I might as well fight.
And the and the result of that has been much fewer attempts at trying to hijack a plane. Where I'm going with this is, if the perpetrator knows that there's going to be resistance,
right?
If the perpetrator knows that the people he's trying to kill are going to shoot back, or even if they don't have a gun, fight back,
right?
Guess what happens? He has a whole different calculus.
Well, look at the pirates among Somalia and stuff. Now, you know, now we have ships going and having armed guards on them. It's completely changed the calculus that's there. The types of flagships that have armed guards, you find that the Somali pirates are staying away from those ships now because they know that they're unlikely to be successful in boarding and capturing those ships. They go after the ships that they still go after, which are weaker targets.
Right. And that's exactly what we're saying in a macro sense here. Instead of one airplane or one ship, if indeed in all of Santa Barbara County, or King County now tonight in Seattle, if just a general thought by a would-be perpetrator was, I'm going to get off 2 rounds maybe, it might change the calculus.
Now, well, I mean, we have the explicit quotes from Elliot Rodger. He wanted to kill people. He was going to commit suicide. I mean, it's amazing when you read the manifesto there how much detail he goes into on these things. But he wanted to die. But he wanted to take as many victims as he could with him. He knew he would get attention from doing that. He doesn't want to go into a place where somebody kills him, though, or stops him before he's able to kill a lot of people.
Right.
You know, you look at
so the argument, that's a very important point. The argument from the critics who say, well, he wants to die, so guns won't deter him, is totally wrongheaded because he wants to take people with him when he dies.
Yeah, he wants to get attention. Look at Adam Lanza in Newtown. He apparently spent 2.5 years planning his attack, and one of the things that he did during that time was put together a massive 7.5 by 4 foot Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, let's get to that spreadsheet on the other side of the break, that Lanza spreadsheet. I think that is probative, as they say in the court of law. John Lott will continue on the other side.